everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today the theme is the dark underbelly of the Great Reset, or as some would have us believe, we are now in the process of being absorbed into and transformed through the Fourth Industrial Revolution. My guest is Alison McDowell. Alison is a mother and an independent researcher currently investigating the background and specifics of the World Economic Forum strategies behind the Great Reset. She blogs about the intersection of race, technology, finance, and nature. Alison has a strong history in educational activism in opposition to high-stakes testing and the standardized curriculum. Her research later expanded into the military origins of educational technology, blockchain identity, and financing in global poverty management. Her website is wrenchinthegears.com. Wrenchinthegears.com. Nice to have you with us today, Alison.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Alison, in the coming months, I plan to do more programs than focus on what is being called the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution that is being strategized and launched by the World Economic Forum and its enormous network of corporate and banking elites. Although this has been planned for many years, decades actually, the pandemic is now being manipulated, we believe, as an opportunity for this capitalist consortium to begin acting on it. I would argue that the birth of the Fourth Industrial Revolution can be traced back to the first Bush White House following two events. First was the collapse of the Soviet Union, which completely shifted the geopolitical landscape away from being defined by two military superpowers and opened the floodgates for corporate globalization. And by the way, especially cannibalizing whatever state assets the former Soviet Union had back in 1991. And they made some people oligarch billionaires. But a lot of money flowed out of the Soviet Union because of American capitalists going in there to exploit it. Also, I would say that the second event was the first Gulf War that brought the former military-controlled internet to the public. We might recall that it was journalists reporting from the war who were first given access to the internet to relay their reports. I make note of this because the Great Reset heavily relies upon all the advances in digitalized technology and data collection and artificial intelligence and robotics and 24/7 surveillance, real-time medical monitoring, wireless technology, and now 5G and 6G. Consequently, the entire bedrock, the foundation, the progenitor of the Great Reset is technological. It means to re-envision the current economic regime that is aligned with the financial opportunities that these new technologies offer. But I want you to kick this off, please. Despite many others starting to write about the Great Reset, you bring something completely novel that I do not find in any other person's mentioning. You have a much greater appreciation and understanding of how many of these new technological instruments, such as blockchain and the new ways our personal data can be hedged and converted into enormous profits while simultaneously implementing greater economic, educational, and social control over the population. We will get into that, but first, please share your own experience about what you have found are some of the real social dangers in right in front of us. That is there, it's not hidden, about this Great Reset, and what you encounter in that most deeply concerned you and compelled you to research it further. Take your time, the forum is yours.
Sure. Well, just to give my background, I'm a parent, and our child went through the Philadelphia public school system, which was a crucible of various types of privatization. They went all the way through 13 years, and during the course of my engagement with that, I began to understand and sort of become less naive about what was happening, that things were being broken on purpose, and to serve the creation of global investment markets in data and data analytics tied to education technology. And you're very correct that it's important to understand these technologies as fundamentally militarized technologies, because I think many times we think of them that they're, very useful and fun and, help us do all these things, but fundamentally they are military technology. And I recommend often Yasha Levine's book, Surveillance Valley, which is a military history of the internet, particularly around cloud-based computing. So I came into it through education and then realized that it wasn't just about tracking and creating markets in education data, but it was also about essentially broader poverty management. So treating human beings and their social relationships as commodities that could be turned into data and from which that data could be turned into profit. And that it was not simply just around selling software or selling hardware or selling, server space. It was actually about using what's called pay-for-success contracting, government contracting, to create new innovative debt products. And these debt products would essentially transform our social relationships and our lives of people who rely on public benefits into these debt instruments. And the primary areas of data collection would be, as I see them, education slash training, because now they're reframing education as lifelong learning, sort of that's their term, in the future of work, that we will have precarious employment and our whole life we will be chasing a new set of skills to compete in an online global talent marketplace. So it will also be healthcare. That is inclusive of mental health care and behavioral health, as well as substance use treatment. Okay, so all of these things will be tracked through the electronic health record systems that came online largely with Zeke Emanuel and Obama and the Affordable Care Act. So that was important to create the data analytics for the health and mental health sector. And then coming online next will be also housing and nutrition. So both food stamps and housing vouchers, much of the public housing has been privatized through voucher-based systems, and we've seen all of these in Philadelphia. But increasingly, all of these technologies are linked into what you would call a key element of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is what's called the Internet of Things. And the Internet of Things is a new concept of computing in which our environment becomes smart, that we are living in an environment full of sensors that are relaying and gathering information and aggregating information about us. So in many respects, everyone, most people have a smartphone. That is a very basic Internet of Thing that is tracking information about you. But it can also be they're building it into built environments, smart street lamps, right? They're putting sensors in paint, sensors in pavement. They're even coming up with neural sensors that, can be put in through nanotechnology. So all of these sensors, which are gathering information that create environments that are layered with data and predictive analytics. So all of this data is being collected, including housing. That's what I wanted to mention. The housing vouchers. Increasingly, we think of, I live in a city of historic housing stock. My house is over 120 years old, but they can add new technologies, Nest, which is the in-home temperature sensing, the Alexas, your smart televisions, retinal scan doorbells, the Ring doorbell systems. All of these things are adding smart technologies that can track one's behavior in one's living environment. So the idea is that all of these services that would be provided by the government, whether that is your access to government-subsidized education, healthcare, or housing, or also nutrition access, that those would be turned into investment markets. And this is being done through a system of outcomes-based government contracts. And so these contracts go back at least to the mid-1990s. There's a gentleman, Arthur Rolnick. He was a senior economist out of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve. And he partnered with a former General Mills executive, Stephen Rothschild. And they set up performance-based government contracting structures in the Twin Cities area. And it sort of simmered there because they didn't have the technology in the mid-1990s, the cloud computing and the other things to really scale these government contracts tied to data analytics in the way that they would want. But by the early 2000s, Sir Ronald Cohen, who is with Social Finance and Big Society Capital, he is a Harvard MBA, and he's also known as the father of UK venture philanthropy. And he created, used these government contracts to create something called social impact bonds. And so essentially, he interwove within sort of the social support net of the United Kingdom these debt instruments, the first of which was tied to reincarceration, recidivism. It was at a place called the Peterborough Prison. And so they created this idea of essentially investment markets where they would establish a cost offset against a predicted future burden on the state. So if you can imagine, and the financiers are really clever about really just making up rules of games. So it may not fully make sense, but if you imagine that the way they crashed the last global economic with that, the mortgage, the asset-backed securities and the mortgages, that was debt tied to real estate. The next set of debt will be tied against human capital, human beings and their future potential, earning potential. So they're securitizing people is what's happening. And the way in which they're doing that is that they would calculate your predicted burden against needing training, needing housing, needing food assistance, needing behavioral health, that being involved in the judicial system, which of course the prison industrial complex is a huge cost offset. And then they would say, if we can preemptively fix you from the burden we've predicted you will be, sometimes multiple burdens, we'll put a price on how much we were expecting you're gonna cost the public coffers. And then we will preemptively fix you with our evidence-based solution that our handy dandy nonprofit or faith community provider will issue, and it will collect all sorts of data on you. And then we will use that data to justify, because the solution we're using to fix you isn't as expensive is letting you be broken, right? So there's a lesser cost set up against a much larger projected cost. And then there's a gap between those two. And these government contracts will negotiate a space in that gap to be the profit center for the investors. And so these investors, there have been pilot programs set up all around the world, largely in sort of, the colonial centers, I mean, the United Kingdom, Canada, the US and Australia, among other spaces. And they've created these social impact bonds now called Pay for Success Finance. And they have pilots and things like pre-K, things around prison, job training, substance use, mental health, and they've piloted them. And they're in a position now that they want to bring these to scale, because these global debt markets only work if they can happen at a massive level, right? The asset-backed securities on the mortgages only worked when they were happening at a massive level. And they haven't been able to scale them yet, because what they actually need on this is to create the cost offset, to do the predictive profiling and to legitimize these deals, which are fully illegitimate. I mean, don't make any mistake. The programs that they're advancing are in many ways fully fictitious. But if Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and UBS and the Vatican and everyone agrees to play this game, the game will go on, right? So there's vast amounts of money poured into this, but what they need is a digital identity system, because they can't pretend that if they provided your child pre-K services, that they didn't need special education if the pre-K data doesn't touch the K-12 education data. They can't say that they prevented a youth from being incarcerated or being drug addicted if the education data doesn't touch the mental health and behavioral health data. So they need these very large data lakes that will be interoperable. The gold for them is interoperable data. And that is coming through what's called a digital identity system, likely run on blockchain, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. And the World Wide Web Consortium has been working on creating these digital identity systems in concert with the push for electronic government and digital government.
I did some research to discover that it was first hypothesized back in 1991 as a cryptographic secured chain of blocks, but was later fully established as a model in 2008 by a person connected with the online Bitcoin currency who went by the fake name of Satoshi Nakamoto. But now, unbeknownst to the vast majority of Americans, blockchain is creeping into many areas of our lives, such as in the educational system, the health system. So you're going to have to, when you make a statement, understand something. You're so familiar with this. You have such a depth of scholarship that you're rattling off information a mile a minute, and 90% of that's not going to be understood by the average person unless you stop and say, here's how this will affect you, or has already.
The structure is the privatization of the entire social welfare system as a private investment market. People need to understand that, okay? Everything will become privatized through public-private partnerships, and it will be framed as progressive, right? Right now, the people who are most advancing this program are people, Democrats, liberals, and people on the left, right? So it's a trap, and they don't understand that it's a trap, okay? So they are privatizing the entire social welfare system. It is based on data analytics and predictive profiling that is tied into the data that you will create interacting both in smart environments and with the government, okay? So that's very important to understand as well. It's important to understand the cost offsets, okay? And that's where the profit lies, because many people don't understand how it works. These deals have to exist so that not the profit isn't in the impact market, that the slice that the investors are getting to when they hit the performance contracts. What's actually going to be happening is that they're going to securitize all of that debt, and then the hedge funds are going to gamble on people's lives. Okay, so the money isn't in the contracts, but the hedge funds do not have a game to play until the contracts are in place. And those contracts depend on digital identity. Okay. So the digital identity system that may very well be on blockchain, it may not be in the first round, but that is the goal, is to put all of your interactions in your life on a permanent ledger. The state of Illinois has a task force that was doing a blockchain task force report in 2018, and they had a pilot to put birth certificates on blockchain. So they would put you on blockchain from birth. In 2018, the first baby was born on blockchain in Tanzania. These systems have been piloted through the so-called humanitarian aid and the development aid systems, both in the UK and the US. So the woman who gave birth, she was put on, given a blockchain identity, her unborn child was given a blockchain identity, and the way in which they accessed the healthcare system for their prenatal care was tied to blockchain. And that was being set up as an impact market. And her compliance with the protocol for healthcare was that there were tokenized behaviors on blockchain that she could redeem for something. They give an example like an umbrella. You could earn, through your good behavior to the system, you could earn a token, you know, for some chit. It's script, right? And so what I'm saying is that we need to think, these are real examples that are taking place. These are the pilots. I am all for women having access to quality prenatal care, right? I think that it shouldn't be a global investment market. And I think that if you are a Black woman in Africa relying on certain medical systems that were backed by global pharma, you might have some concerns if you were required to not be able to make your own decisions about your own health choices and that you were being pushed and tracked on blockchain. I think that there are some really legitimate issues regarding who is in control of the health systems and where does our sort of free choice about our own health decisions come into play. So that is another one of these examples. But the blockchain identity is going to be, right now it's optional, right? If you are a refugee, they will give you a blockchain identity. Maybe if you need to access the free college, community college program that's happening in Dallas and Tulsa, then you get a blockchain transcript. They set you up on blockchain. But that's not everybody, right? And for these markets to scale, they need everybody on blockchain. They need to make everyone be on blockchain. And that is why the pandemic situation is so valuable to them, because under threat of national security, they can require people to have a health passport to confirm your health status in terms of your mobility or access to employment or access to education. And at this point, then it becomes not optional, right? They can compel someone to be on blockchain, where before that, you couldn't compel people to be on blockchain. So that's what's coming with the Common Pass project. That is a project of the Rockefeller Foundation and the World Economic Forum. The mobility pass is being piloted at Heathrow Airport, tied to air travel. And that is getting some play. People are paying attention to that. But the two other products that are tied to that are there's a product around access to employment and your employment and your education. And then there's another one that's tied to real-time bio data, right? So there's three products there. They're only right now talking about the very limited one about airport travel. So these biometric identities are what's needed for the financial markets.
Okay. Well, look how easy it is to get all the information they need. Right now on people's cell phones, the most common way of opening your phone is with your thumbprint. So that means they have everyone's fingerprints. That then ties into a database. They have the cell phones can take photographs, can record you. So now they can have all of your voice and all of your facial features. They also, every device in your house, every smart device, like Alexa. Alexa, whatever the question is, Alexa's not just answering you, Alexa's recording every single thing that you say, or if it videos, does in your house. And how many people have Alexa in their bedroom, a kitchen, or someplace else? So every single thing you think or do during a day that you express by writing, calling, or even a conversation of privacy in your own home is now on a data system. Once all that data is collected at every level, even your cars, even in my own car, which is a small little car, they wanted to put a new update, and I said no. And they said, why not? I said, because right now they cannot track my car. And I don't have a GPS, and I also don't carry a cell phone in the car. And it's through your cell phone that Google, and we didn't know this till a year ago, Google can show you exactly where you've driven every day, how long you were at a place, what location you were at, when you left, etc. And then they can record everything you say in a car. So and now this new system, which says it's upgrading it, no, it can take over your car for you. It gives them greater access to knowing what you're saying, what you're doing, who you're with. And I don't believe they should have a right to that information, because all they're going to do is try to, in some way, control some aspect of my life. And we've known for years that the Operation Stingray, where the police departments have vans that can download cell phones within a certain period of space. And those are not criminals. They even have a van that can drive down a street. They can film everything going on in your house, your conversation, your body, where you're at, as if they have a right to invade the sanctity of your home, even though you've not been targeted as a criminal. But they have targeted for criminal actions everyone that's protested. Every protest of any kind, you're now considered no better than an enemy terrorist or domestic terrorist. And that has been proven because WikiLeaks let us know that information. So all this collection of data, everything, even though there's laws against it, and Barack Obama sided with the tech companies when it was exposed that AT&T and Verizon and others were collecting our phone data without legal merit or due process, it was all forgiven. So what does that tell you about where they're going with all this information, and how do they profit from all this?
Well, you're right about Obama. So much of the social impact investing program was developed under his administration, and the Social Innovation Fund and partnerships with third sector capital partners. to get these pilots. And this was coming through, you know, esteemed universities through Harvard Kennedy School and Georgetown and Stanford and Wharton, where I am in Philadelphia. So the academic, the higher education elite are all part of enabling the research and the equations for these human capital bond markets that are being set up. It's important to know that, I guess you're based in New York. So Google has, or Alphabet has, both their smart city division, Sidewalk Labs, which is at, what is the name at the end of the High Line? The Hudson Yards? Sidewalk Labs, yes, is based in Hudson Yards. Google Alphabet also has a new healthcare management program called CityBlock, which is based in Brooklyn. And I feel very strongly that that program is to manage the health of complex urban populations. And that CityBlock is probably very likely not a reference to an actual Sesame Street type block, but actually blockchain, right? Michael Bloomberg is very much invested in the health space. And he was the former ambassador to the United Nations for climate change and to the World Health Organization. And he created Cornell Technion, Cornell Tech on Roosevelt Island in New York City. He created a campus for education technology and health data analytics. And on that campus, which he poured a lot of his own money into, Google provided a lot of money to start that up, and many hedge funds and global philanthropies to create the Cornell Tech campus on Roosevelt Island. They have a small data lab where they're doing all sorts of data analytics of sort of this small ephemeral data that you throw off during your day, the type of thing that you were talking about. And I think many people might say, well, knowing that, I'm not going to carry a phone, I'm not going to have Alexa in my house, I'm going to refuse all of these things. But what we're seeing with the pandemic and the lockdowns is that we are viewing an intentional push to make people dependent on the state, to close down businesses, to foreclose people's economic independence and actually make them dependent on the state. And I reinforce this in many ways, that this is a long history of things that we have done to indigenous people and black people, enslaved people, is to remove their ability to be outside the system and push them into these structures. And that is definitely what is coming. And then once you are a dependent on, whether it's universal basic income or some sort of services that are underpinned by these human capital bonds, they will make you be trackable, right? They will make your data be collectible, and that will be the condition of you participating in the system. And many people, I live in Philadelphia, it's a low-income city, we're one of the poorest big cities, and people who are trying to navigate social service systems already know the degree to which it's a game, that you have to figure out how to play the rules of this game. It's about to become even more treacherous, because what we're talking about is having these bond markets tied to essentially assigning you pathways of behavioral compliance, of workforce training, of healthcare management, of, you know, addiction treatment. You will be assigned prescriptive pathways that you are supposed to perform proper behaviors, and then you will be tracked, whether that's through a portable device like a phone, whether it's through wearable technology, whether they're putting Internet of Things on your pill caps to track your medication. You will be watched. And as a dependent of the state, that you will have no rights not to be. You know, and I have a close friend who had a traumatic brain injury and is on long-term disability. And she had one of these inexpensive phones. They call them Obama phones, right? And these phones don't do a whole lot for the individuals, but they're their tracking device, okay? And so, you know, this idea that the poor won't have a phone to be tracked, that's not true. They will give you the phone because that is what they need to turn you into a data commodity. And then they will, you know, you will be compelled to live in an environment that monitors your data analytics. And so, you know, I'm coming at this not just for how do I protect myself and my family, but how do we actually preserve humanity? Because what is coming is very much, I believe, an approach that is anti-life, that is turning people into domestic livestock, I mean, into just robotic machines in service of global capital. And so when we organize, we need to organize together. Not just that, you know, how can I go hide out in a cave somewhere and take care of mine? Like, we're really literally up in a fight against for humanity as it is. And this is a global takeover. This is transnational global capital. You know, IBM, Goldman Sachs, SoftBank, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, they have no borders. Capital has no borders. They want borders to be for people, and they would like to be able to use geofencing to, you know, what I'm trying to tell, like, the immigration community is that with real-time limiting your mobility through sensor data, they can make the border your front door in real time if you are not complying with the program. And so we really have to get our mindset around what this new reality is and to sort of step out of partisan boxes, because in many respects, I've been very disappointed that people who advance this idea of justice are not understanding that what is coming with state dependency isn't any sort of care or liberation. It actually means that we will become part of portfolios of Goldman Sachs. You know, and not even ourselves, like children, right, who have no voice to say no. And so we need to understand this for what it actually is.
Okay, that said, two of the most important programs for everyone would be Medicaid at the state level and Medicare for senior citizens. How can blockchain be used in healthcare like Medicare and Medicaid and even the entire wellness industry?
Right. Well, as I had mentioned that, it's that they needed the interoperable data, so that electronic health records is a key part of that. And again, you know, Zeke Emanuel was part of getting that in place. You know, that was coming out of Harvard, and you know, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. It's the commodities markets. So the data on the emphasis moving forward will sound good. They will say that we care about preventative healthcare and we care about you know, community health. And that's the language that they will use. But what it means is that you will have to earn your right to healthcare, right? It won't just be given. You will have to show that you have complied. The idea of patient compliance will become central, because that is what the debt service will be connected to. And so right now I was just doing research this morning on Sweden, because these are essentially what they're talking about is health as a startup. And so once you're talking about cloud-based computing and biotechnology and turning people into data, these financial instruments can be developed anywhere in the world. And they're often, again, piloted through aid systems in the United Nations. Once they have the software pilot, it can be uploaded anywhere, right? It could be uploaded from Brazil to Canada to Australia. It's ephemeral. So we're not safe just because something feels far away. So this first health impact bond in Sweden, which has socialized medicine, was around diabetes prevention, okay? So they have technologies now to create data streams around your food consumption. There's a company, Imperial College London, that created this first report that had all of these really horrific numbers, projections about the pandemic that didn't happen. They actually, in their R&D division, had spun off a company called DNA Nudge. And their Internet of Things wearable technology, where you would scan your food and it would tell you what food you should buy based on your DNA. Okay, and a lot of this is actually tied back in way back into early 20th century eugenics. Okay, so imagine that you're on food stamps. The Illinois State Task Force on Blockchain had a thought experiment, hadn't been implemented, where they would code your choices about your food purchases on blockchain. So you would be given a digital wallet, and if you made the right choice, they would kick back a little digital money into your wallet. So if you bought the apple instead of the hamburger, they would reward you theoretically. Realistically, we know that over time, they will just cut back the amount that you can't get through the month until you always make the right choice. But so you tie a DNA nudge band, right, to digital food assistance, right? And then you layer it into a pay for success deal tied to preventing diabetes, you know, preventing someone who is like early onset. Essentially, what we're saying is we're forcing people to live in environments that are unhealthy, that have not good access to food, and then we are going to put them on a pathway to quote unquote health by monitoring them and turning them into data that someone can invest in. right? And then the trick is once they become an investment that way, someone can short that position, right? So that there's also people in the hedge fund industry that would be shorting your ability to pursue the proper caretaking of your health program. So, you know, within Medicare and Medicaid, it's going to be focused on wellness and prevention, but they're not going to do that in terms of cleaning up the environment and addressing environmental racism and providing healthy food. They're going to make people, low-income people, as commodities, try to navigate an impossible system under a magnifying glass with their data captured as an investment commodity. And that is what is coming through these wearable technologies. You know, it hasn't fully manifested yet, but you can see in Australia, there was a journalist who was writing that that you should have to walk for the dole. She had an op-ed that you should have to walk for the dole. So your phone or your wearable technology would track you if you were getting public assistance, that you'd walked enough. Right. And I work in a public park setting. All that would take would be to put a QR code on the entry sign, right? And that you would have to check in order to qualify for your prescription medications or your, diabetic socks or whatever, like that you would have to show that you had done your part, you know, for the system. Even though realistically many poor people are trying to navigate daily crises that make it almost impossible just to like get day to day, let alone get ahead. I don't know, does that help?
It does. Now, if you would please draw a distinction for us. For many years, Klaus Schwab has advocated for replacing shareholder capitalism, which is part of the current neoliberal paradigm that emerged from the economic theories of Milton Friedman, with what is called stakeholder capitalism. Almost a decade ago, Schwab wrote about this in a New York Times essay. So he has been advocating for shareholder capitalism for quite a while. As I understand it, stakeholder capitalism is based more upon private-public partnerships. So what are the sharp differences between shareholder and stakeholder capitalism? I believe the same people who are powerful and control both will end up still controlling both. Or is a stakeholder capitalism just the same neoliberal capitalism disguised differently by having some members of the company, the factory, the business on the board, but not enough to make a difference in ultimate policy making?
Okay. So if you imagine with the fourth industrial revolution, the goal is to replace huge amounts of human labor, including not just industrial manufacturing, but also service and knowledge work with machines, with robots, with artificial intelligence, with things that are not people. What we're dealing with is a world of massive dispossession. So the last phase of globalization, we saw the rise of the prison industrial complex. So many in the Black and Brown community who were thrown out of work were put into carceral states, and then new business models were built up around servicing people in those environments to pull money out of them. This next version, there will be so many people put out of work that they won't even be able to do anything with them. So, you know, essentially that's what we're looking at, a global open air prison is what's coming. Capital needs to continue to grow, and capital must circulate. So we're running up against a moment in which the mass of dispossessed people and the more that are coming will not have the liquidity to function in the market the way they have been expected to function, right? Everyone is saddled with debt, people don't have cash flow, and so the machine will fall apart unless a new paradigm is created. And this new paradigm is going to be stakeholder capitalism built on top of both human capital bonds and social impact bonds tied to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Okay, so this is all running. The World Economic Forum has partnered with the United Nations last January. And so the structure of this is running through the Sustainable Development Goals, most of which are actually about managing poor people. There's a limited number of goals that are actually about managing the environment, but they're interconnected. These parameters were set up by Judith Rodin, who is the former president of the University of Pennsylvania, where I am. She helped create the Global Impact Investment Network through the Rockefeller Foundation. Okay, and this was all happening in the lead up to the last global economic catastrophe in 2007. In Bellagio, they all met. They sort of agreed that this would be the new phase, but it has to be sold. What we're wading through right now is weaponized narrative and trying to understand what's being sold to us. So they sold it to us as stakeholder capitalism, that these same companies that created environmental devastation, that created mass poverty, that collapsed the global real estate market, that now they've just felt bad about it, and they're going to create a new model, and they're going to try to clean up their problems. Only cleaning up their problems means putting us into a global prison and tracking us as data commodities. That part they're not going to tell us, but that is what's coming. And the Rockefeller Foundation funded something called the B Lab. So benefit corporations or the fourth sector is this new hybrid sort of beneficent capitalist structure that's going to come in and sort of harvest all of the misery and trauma that was created and repackage it to create more profit for themselves, which sounds crazy, but that's actually what's happening. So the benefit corporation laws initially were trialed in California, tied to California Medicaid. And Schwarzenegger was governor at the time, and he vetoed it, but said it seemed like a great idea. And so they brought it back into Philadelphia, and they created these model benefit corporation laws. So many stakeholder capitalism, one of the primary functions, at least in the US, is the idea of benefit corporations. Now, these are lifted up like, you know, Ben and Jerry's is a benefit corporation. You know, they sort of pitch it as like fair trade, you know, shade grown coffee and fair trade textiles and very sort of crunchy presentation to this. But it isn't actually. It's that is a veneer. But what is underneath it are the public-private partnerships that will essentially raid all of the public sector and put us all onto blockchain. And that's the part that's not being said. So even in their own documents, they show the evolution from the like the colonial capitalist to the stakeholder capitalist, and it's very unpleasant. And they think this is lovely. This is their own document, but from you know an ape to a fancy businessman with a tablet, and they sort of visually show themselves as their evolution of capitalism, thinking that like we're all going to go along, that this is a wonderful program. The other thing about stakeholder, the benefit corporations, is that the laws say that in regular companies that you are supposed, that the boards are supposed to pursue the highest level of profit for the shareholders. And so the way the shift to stakeholder capitalism and the IRS has allowed this is that if you, it enables them to not pursue the highest profit, which on the surface sounds nice, but what you're realizing is you're never going to get the highest profit anymore because everyone is in massive poverty. So it's sort of a gentle way of shielding boards of directors from accountability under the guise of benevolence, that these shareholder capitalists, that they're the good guys because they care about you. They care about you enough to make you, put you into a pay for success finance deal and put your toddler on a surveillance play table.
Did you ever see the movie Soylent Green with Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson?
I've heard of it, but
there's an interesting scene. It's very dystopian, and Charlton Heston plays a detective, and there's a murder of a wealthy person. He goes into the apartment, and what he notices there that there's a jar of jam, and he takes it. He takes some other food and takes it back to Edward G. Robinson, who is called the book, because he's the one who has the knowledge and researches stuff. In any case, Edward G. Robinson, you know, begins to cry that night when they actually have some real food. And he says he remembers when he was younger, you know, you could have meals, you have fruits and vegetables. Now just the rich have this. At the end of the program, all the Soylent Green was actually people who had chosen to go in, and they would have take a drink, and before the drink killed them, they would be able to watch scenes of nature and any scene they wanted, and it showed this. And then, boom, the lights go out. They shoot it down into a vat and become Soylent Green. That was the movie, but always it's the same. How then Will the wealthy people and the professional class, who are upper middle class wealthy, lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists, how will they be able to be affected? The very rich affected, the super rich affected. We have different classes of rich versus the poor working class or the existing working class and the poor class.
Well, the billionaire class, I mean, they've already staked out their, you know, places in their giant ranches or their private islands. And I think we saw there was some stuff going around early on in the pandemic, like, look, these 60 CEOs all quit this past year and like walked away. So, you know, they knew what was going to be unfolding. So I think the people with the most resources, they're off grid. They're not part of the Internet of Bodies. They're not going to be subject to this. Even if everyone gets a digital identity, if you're not reliant on the public system, you can just keep your data locked up on blockchain and you don't have to show it to anyone, right? And the reality is that if you are reliant on a public benefit service, then your data will be available to be queried for impact markets. And that's just the way it's going to go. I think a lot more of the professional class are going to be lumped in with the working poor. And with people who are doing precariat micro work through haptic telepresence labor assigned by AI, because the fourth industrial revolution is going that direction if we don't refuse it. And I think we still can, because I think actually if people understood what the fourth industrial revolution meant, your child was going to be taught by an algorithm, by an avatar, by a synthetic person, that your elders are going to be cared for by someone on a tablet. That we're only going to ever get telemedicine or nanotechnology pills. We're going to take care of our needs. We're social creatures, and most people would refuse that. But they're not. They're being sold a bill of goods that it's some beautiful future. But the rich won't have to be. If they're on blockchain, they won't have to share their data. Everyone else will be profiled. And what I want to emphasize is that the smart cities run on blockchain smart contracts. These Ethereum smart contracts. It's a contracting system, and you had mentioned that early on about the ledgers. It's a decentralized digital ledger. Just like the slave trade grew off of double entry bookkeeping and the doctrine of discovery that was advanced through the Catholic Church, we're now, the blockchain is the next ledger, the next permanent record. And so for a while at least, really the accountants and the lawyers will be busy, and the coders writing all of these codes. They actually have to code this world into being. It's not fully realized. And the push for STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math for children so that they don't know anything about literature or art, it's so that they can make them build the virtual world. Capitalism is going into the virtual world, and that is the only way that it can continue expanding on a planet of finite resources. And that's what the left doesn't get, is that the capitalism isn't falling apart, it's expanding into the virtual realm. And it's a militarized space that it is being expanded into.
So, okay, I'd like, again, let me add something to this, and then I'd like you to respond to it. We just saw something that's important. For the first time, the major media reported that Hunter Biden was under investigation by the Department of Justice, the FBI, for tax problems with all the millions upon millions of dollars he made. But this has been going on for more than 2 years. What we did not have any of the mainstream platforms such as Google, Facebook, none of them mentioned, or Wikipedia, none of them were mentioning Hunter Biden's and his father, Joe Biden, the vice president, financial dealings. And then when the New York Post came up with a story about a whistleblower, in fact, it was Hunter Biden's business partner, the man who actually ran Hunter Biden's companies, came forward and told the truth on Tucker Carlson that Joe Biden was opening the door for his son and then got a 10% kickback, and that's and that this man was there at the meeting. So Joe Biden said and misinformed the public, I had no knowledge what my son's business dealings. To the contrary, he was fully aware of his son's dealing. In fact, he actually admitted it at sitting in a chair at the Council on Foreign Relations after a lecture, saying, yeah, I went to I went to the Ukraine and I told the, you know, president that you want this $1 billion, you know, then you fire your attorney general. And the attorney general was investigating Burisma, that Hunter Biden was getting a lot of money with no experience, no knowledge, no background whatsoever. And it was clearly a quid pro quo. And he said, well, I made sure that, you know, if he's not fired before I leave in 6 hours, you don't get the money. Well, they fired the person, and later that person was shown to have done everything correctly, and his successor also did everything correctly, and both of them said that, you know, this was a criminal organization. Not a word in the American media about that. Nothing. So we were lied to. We were held. Information that would have made us differently approach the topic of Joe Biden's qualifications to be president were intentionally kept off all social media and kept out of the mainstream media. So Google, nothing. And in fact, they would use their algorithms, as did Facebook, to gear people to not having any information that would have been detrimental to the Democrats. Now, I don't care if you're Democrat or Republican. The public needs to know all the facts, let them see the truth, and then make their decision who they want. And but that didn't happen. Now, hold on a second. Now Google is saying, we are now going to censor, as of today, any challenge by a person, an article, anything that questions the legitimacy of the election process. And yet this same organization and the entirety of the mainstream media for 4 years said that it was not a legal election in 2016 because Russia. There were four separate investigations. Four. All showed there was no collusion. Now, I don't like Trump. I don't like anything about Trump, nor his cabinet or anything else.
All right. But do you mind if I just... So
let me finish my thought, please. All right? So now what you have is you have mainstream websites that are instrumental in collecting data and deciding what you're allowed to know, what you're not allowed to know, lying to us for 4 years. And now they control everything. And but now that Joe Biden is going to be the next president, now they let this out. Now, would this have changed people's minds? Would there have been a different outcome in the election? I don't know. I'm told there would have been about a 5% difference going to Trump instead of Biden. That meant that the people who really controlled that election was the deep state in the form of Google and Facebook and Wikipedia, et cetera, and Twitter, and the censorship, because now everybody's seeing the truth. Now, Glenn Greenwald told the truth. Chris Hedges told the truth. Max Blumenthal told the truth. The zone, Gray Zone reporters told the truth. In other words, all the really legitimate independent investigative journalists told the truth, and they were expunged. They've lost all their platforms. They've been denied access. They've been erased. They've been canceled. They've been shamed. And if these are the best, most honest and objective journalists we have. So we've lost our edge with journalism being open and fair and giving us the truth. We've lost the media doing anything that represents the truth. And so where exactly is the average person supposed to get the truth to make the right decisions about what's in their best interest or not? Because 5G is a disaster. 10,000 studies show that, showing its dangers. Not a word from the media. In fact, the New York Times is complicit in promoting 5G. They haven't shown us what's wrong with glyphosate. It took Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and some other attorneys to show us that. In fact, everything is wrong. You won't hear a word from the mainstream media or the government or the social platforms. It's just, it is, my question then is, where are people who are already very vulnerable to being motivated by fear? Where are they supposed to get the truth to pull away from all this?
Well, it's a challenge. I will just say regarding the election, I've written a lot about Davos because I think that's where the power is. And what's unfolding is fully bipartisan. I just want to emphasize that. And I think in many respects, the whole Trump presidency has, and the Democratic response to it has been meant to drive people farther and deeper into their partisan positions so that they're fighting one another and not actually looking at the World Economic Forum and who's the global capital, which is the problem. And many folks are saying what's happening is socialist or communist. It's absolutely not. This is happening through transnational global capital. And that's where we need to look. And it is global. Much of it based in New York and in Silicon Valley and the militarized aspect of that, but it's a global thing, and no one's going to vote that out. So that needs to be very clear. Ivanka Trump was in the world in Davos this January with Mark Benioff on a panel about reskilling. So they all know what's going on, and they're not going to tell you, and they would like for you to actually fight each other than actually look at the structure that is being rolled out.
Okay, solutions journalism. And your website, Alison McDowell, McDowell, is my guest. Her website is wrenchinthegears.com. Thank you very much, Alice, for a very informed hour. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.